Ahora estimo roquea, mi loco.
There have been important changes in U.S. policy since the massacre, but they're all as a result of grassroots pressure, despite what President Clinton said in his first post-election news conference just a few weeks ago.
Indeed, look at the difference in my policy and my predecessor's policy. We changed our policy on arms sales because of East Timor, not to sell small arms. And we co-sponsored the resolution in the United Nations in favor of greater human rights for East Timor.
In fact, these measures represented a defeat of the Clinton White House, State Department, and Pentagon by a bipartisan coalition in Congress responding to pressure from the grassroots. These grassroots victories began with the military training aid, or IMET, cutoff of 1992. Then the reversal of the U.S. stand at the U.N. Human Rights Commission, criticizing Indonesia, the blockage of a shipment of F-5 fighter planes destined for Indonesia, passage through the Senate Foreign Relations Committee of human rights conditions on major arms sales, and then the bans on the sales to Indonesia of small arms and armored cars. In fact, 2 years ago, Clinton used a loophole to get around the IMET ban and resume training of Suharto's army. Then in July of 94, Clinton joined Senator Bob Dole in killing a Leahy-Feingold amendment that would have enforced an existing treaty and banned the use of U.S. weapons in occupied East Timor. Put simply, the U.S. continues to arm and back the Suharto regime. This despite sometimes tough rhetoric, like Vice President Gore just a few years ago.
The essence of the injustice is starkly simple. Unarmed, innocent people in their homeland have been killed and imprisoned and mistreated. It is an abuse of human rights.
Despite these words, in October 1995, when Suharto came to the White House, he was greeted by President Clinton, Vice President Gore, Secretary of State Warren Christopher, Ron Brown, the Secretary of Commerce, Mickey Kanner, the Special Trade Representative at the time, and General John Shalikashvili, Chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Clinton offered to sell Suharto $200 million of F-16 fighter planes. A senior official told the New York Times, "Suharto, he's our kind of guy." After the Nobel Peace Prize announcement, José Ramos Horta commented on the military sales.
"We would be appalled, regret, if U.S. goes ahead with the sale of F-16. Yes, the F-16 might not be usable in East Timor, but it sends a wrong message to a regime that violates human rights. Indonesia is no better than the slaughter in Burma, no better than Iran and Iraq. In fact, the killings in East Timor of students, workers in Indonesia for the past 30 years is of greater proportion than the killings done by Saddam Hussein or by the Pol Pot in Cambodia in terms of proportion of our population. So in particular this time when there is a growing democracy movement in Indonesia and there is crackdown on the democracy movement, it is amazing that the U.S. is even considering selling these weapons. The reintroduction of IMET, military training, would be totally immoral, that the United States should continue such a policy of training military thugs in this country."
While the Riyadi money may have bought White House access and some favors, U.S. policy toward Jakarta has been far more influenced by U.S. firms. Hundreds of multinationals have close links with Suharto. Among them are some two dozen firms, including Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch, Motorola, Hughes Aircraft, that are actually formal business partners with the Suharto family. Suharto has opened up Indonesia's oil and natural gas reserves to exploitation on favorable terms to firms like Texaco and Mobil, while letting out East Timor's stolen offshore oil to Caltex and Phillips Petroleum. Freeport-McMoRan, with Henry Kissinger on its board, uses Indonesian troops to protect its gold mines in West Papua, Indonesia, and to repress indigenous Amungme people protesting spoliation of their lands. The regime's other great resource is a vast supply of repressed labor. Independent unions are banned and organizers disappeared and tortured. Last July, after anti-Suharto riots shook Jakarta, the army launched a major crackdown aiming to intimidate and kill the growing pro-democracy movement. Labor activist Mukhtar Pakpahan was jailed and accused of subversion. He faces a possible death penalty in a trial due to start this month. This labor climate attracts companies like Nike and Reebok, which now do roughly a third of their sneaker production in Indonesia. Both firms are highly image-conscious. Reebok even gives human rights awards. Their next award ceremony is tomorrow. In 1992, they gave one to Fernando de Araujo, a young Timorese man jailed because he protested the Dili massacre. Present on the stage was Paul Fireman, Reebok's CEO, who the year before had made more than $30 million, more than all of Indonesia's sneaker-making workforce combined. Because Fernando was in jail, the Reebok Human Rights Foundation asked Alan Nairn and I if we would come to the award ceremony and describe the massacre that he was protesting. I described the massacre, and then Alan described who supports the military that committed it.
The U.S. has for years supported such repressive regimes, in large part on behalf of U.S. corporations. Inside Indonesia, the government suppresses independent unions, which allows companies to pay near starvation wages. That helps Reebok, Nike, and others make huge profits in Indonesia, paying the workers who make their shoes, many of them young women from the countryside, wages of about $1 per day. Such companies have an obligation to, at the very least, call on Washington to stop shipping arms to the brutal Indonesian regime.
Reebok was not happy with our presentation. Since then, groups like Press for Change have spearheaded successful campaigns to call attention to the exploitation of Indonesian workers, especially at the Nike plants. With such companies in their corner, the Suharto regime has, especially since 1994, lobbied fiercely to offset the grassroots effort to reverse U.S. Timor policy and to resist Indonesian labor rights campaigns by U.S. unions and human rights groups. But while these issues of substance are not now at the focus of U.S. debate, the Riyadi scandal has undeniably created a political opening. Politicians who've backed Suharto or never spoken the words East Timor are suddenly rushing to denounce both the terror and the U.S. policy. Haley Barbour, the Republican chairman, now charges that under Clinton, the United States turns its back on genocide in East Timor. House Speaker Newt Gingrich agrees.
And I think the case against Indonesia is pretty overwhelming in terms of East Timor.
Republican presidential candidate Bob Dole also attacked Clinton's Jakarta ties and specifically raised East Timor, despite his own record of defending Suharto in the Senate. But even as the campaign scandal broke and the Nobel Prizes were announced, the Clinton administration kept on insisting that the weapons sales would go forward. White House Press Secretary Mike McCurry.
I've spoken to both José Ramos Horta and Bishop Bello, and they say Clinton is key in self-determination for East Timor. Will he now continue to push for those weapon sales to Indonesia? José Ramos Horta says it's like selling weapons to Saddam Hussein.
Well, that's not the view of the United States government. We make arms transfers of that nature when they're in the interest of the United States. Again, our goal is to engage in arms transfers in that region that promote stability, defense, security, not to engage in transfers that would involve anything resembling repression of individual rights. Well, you're also advancing U.S. strategic interests in the region.
But despite White House recalcitrance, the Nobel publicity and the scandal have created a climate that make it possible for activists to effectively fight the IMET and major weapons deals. When Newt Gingrich called a pre-election news conference to denounce Clinton in partisan terms, Alan Nairn asked the speaker if he would now oppose IMET restoration and the F-16 sale.
The next big item on the agenda for Suharto is getting those getting that IMET restored, which is a very major thing for his army and for his
well,
military.
I would certainly think that
the Republican leadership last spring, you supported the restoration of the IMET. Will you now reverse that position?
I can't tell you right now. I mean, I think Indonesia is a very, very important country, and I'm not prepared to say that we ought to make foreign policy in response to American domestic politics. But I can tell you that we need to know to what extent the information we were being given by this administration was tainted by Indonesian interest and tainted by the Riyadis and the Lippo Group, and to what extent the administration may not have been giving us straight information.
So you're not willing to come out against the F-16 deal or the IMF?
No, I'm willing to say I think we have to have thorough hearings. We have to see what all the decision documents have been for the last 4 years. We have to find out whether or not we have been misled.
Do you think the sale should be postponed until hearings are completed?
Absolutely. There's no question in my mind that we should postpone any action towards Indonesia until we've had a chance to review this.
Gingrich's call for a suspension of the F-16 sale has been joined by Congressmember Ben Gilman, the Republican chair of the House International Affairs Committee, who promised in a letter to the Washington Post that if necessary, he'll introduce a resolution to block the deal. Whether these officials will keep their commitments remains to be seen. As before, it will undoubtedly depend on the extent of grassroots pressure. Listening to politicians is something José Ramos Horta has been doing for 21 years. He left East Timor at the age of 25, just before Indonesia invaded. He'd been sent to the United Nations to plead East Timor's case, while Ramos Horta got out of East Timor alive. Much of his family has been killed.
I lost one sister and two brothers. The sister, she was 17 when she was killed, along with 20 other kids. Two Bronco aircraft nosedive over a village and blew up the school and 20 kids there. One brother was killed when he was captured. Another, we don't know what exactly happened, but he disappeared during a helicopter assault on a village where he was. But like me, there are many, many other families, and in fact, some even worse. I know families that were totally wiped out. Families that I knew, I grew up with, that no longer exist. I know villages when all my youth I spent there. And when I ask survivors, I'm told that village does no longer exist. It's not on the map. So this is the scale of the tragedy that was imposed on East Timor with U.S. complicity.
How do you hold out hope? You've been outside the country for 17 years. You've been the representative of East Timor at the United Nations for more than a decade. What gives you any hope?
Well, the past 17 years that I've been engaged in a diplomatic struggle, I also have witnessed, and all of us witnessed empires crumbling. No one thought possible 5 years ago, 10 years ago, that the Soviet Union would disintegrate into independent states or Yugoslavia, or the Berlin Wall, the democratization in Africa and elsewhere. And Indonesia will follow the same. It cannot escape the trend of democracy. But apart from that, the resistance in East Timor is continuing at all levels. Armed resistance, one, but also cultural, religious. The entire people are mobilized, and we are very confident. I can state categorically, in the next 3, 5 years, 6 years, maybe a bit longer, East Timor is going to be independent.
Today, José Ramos Horta is the external spokesperson for the Timorese underground. Its leader, Xanana Gusmao, was captured last November after eluding the grasp of the Indonesian military for 17 years. Xanana had also led the remnants of the Timorese guerrilla resistance, fighting in the hills since the invasion. But perhaps his most important role has been as the political leader of the underground, which advocates self-determination, and as even the Indonesian army admits, enjoys vast support across the political spectrum among the surviving East Timorese. Xanana was sentenced to life in prison after a trial Amnesty International denounced as a travesty of justice. Close associates and members of his family had been arrested by Indonesian troops. Some were tortured, others killed. And when Xanana attempted to read his own defense at his trial, he was silenced by the Indonesian court. But a copy of his statement was smuggled out. In the 28-page handwritten document prepared in secret in his cell, Xanana called for self-determination and independence, said the resistance struggle would continue no matter what, and denounced the governments of the United States and Australia for their complicity in the occupation. He also specifically called on President Clinton to reconsider the U.S. stand and to pressure Jakarta into a dialogue in search of an internationally acceptable solution. From his jail cell, Xanana launched a hunger strike. His sentencing and the accompanying repression drew international condemnation. In captivity, Xanana remains a symbol of national resistance, a figure of Nelson Mandela-like stature among the East Timorese. This tape of his voice was smuggled out 1 year before his capture.
We have not saddened with our pain. We open our eyes to the immense suffering of the 16 years. We are not afraid of blood. We think of the determination of our people. The struggle continues on every front.
The UN Secretary General is now sponsoring diplomatic talks on the future status of East Timor. The talks are between Indonesia and Portugal, which the UN recognizes as East Timor's administering power. Shanana and others have called for Timorese participation in the talks, a petition which Indonesia has, to this point, refused. Senior UN officials have told us that Indonesia's posture in the end will turn most heavily on whether the United States continues to arm and back the Suharto regime. While it's an open question what the future holds for the Timorese, the scale of the genocide is inescapable. Most Timorese have lost at least one member of their family. Many young children have lost both their parents. We visited one of East Timor's many orphanages, which, like many of the Timorese who dare to speak out, must go unnamed. The children welcomed us with a song.
A little way at 4 a.m. I woke up and I couldn't find anybody. Mother and father, where are you? You left me all alone.
Old women in traditional dress of East Timor, young men, young women, little kids, and they marched up to the cemetery. When we got to the cemetery, again, there were thousands of people. The Indonesian army converged in two places. They beat me and dragged me over and started slamming me with rifle butts and kicks and punches. And then Alan jumped on top of me, and they beat him very badly. But that was the least of what they did. They opened fire on the people.
Massacre, the story of East Timor, produced by Alan Nairn and Amy Goodman, our engineer, Errol Maitland. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to this special edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! On International Human Rights Day.